Singing Dutchman Productions. Hello, and welcome to Doug's Front Porch, a podcast where I get to sit down with friends, old and new, and have honest conversations. Today, I welcome Dr. Bill Donner to the front porch, a friend who I've known for quite a long time, but I've never had the chance to ask him some of the questions that I have for him today, so I can't wait to do that. Bill, thanks so much for coming on the front porch.
That's a pleasure. Pleasure, Doug. I know I got to put a comment into your viewers. You know, you really are active on YouTube and the internet. You're really doing a fantastic job with all your different projects. You know, the Ask a Dutchman, and then the language learning, and this. It's really remarkable. So I'm very happy to be here, and I think you should really be complimented on all the work you're doing.
Well, thanks, Bill. It's no better way to start a conversation than that. So I usually start each episode the same way to give the audience an opportunity to get to know the guest a little bit more. So I always ask this question. Tell us a little bit about, you know, where you grew up. What kind of things was Bill as a child into? Did he play sports? Was he a musical kid? What did your childhood look like?
Oh, I had a good childhood. I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And I guess, you know, I don't know. I had a good time. Now, for the Pennsylvania German side, I talk about this in my book. I was growing up in the 1950s, and it was not cool to have anything German in your name, at least down in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And, you know, our parents had fought in wars against the Germans, and my grandparents had fought in another war against the Germans. So I didn't want people to know I had any German ancestry. And I remember, you know, I just remember so vividly being like 8 or 9. And one of the bigger kids who's 12 or 13, he was saying to this other kid, "Oh, you fat kraut." And, you know, they're just a kid like us. But there was a lot of prejudice. So I wasn't happy about that. My household, actually, my mother's grandfather, she had been raised with him. Again, in the suburbs of Philadelphia, but he had come from Wilmersdorf, and she had been brought back to Wilmersdorf. And there was always this Pennsylvania Dutch connection. You know, there was like a blanket chest there that actually she had painted Pennsylvania Dutch designs on, and there were other kind of artifacts of Pennsylvania Dutchness. Now, my upbringing was really straight up vanilla, suburban, American, you know, I don't know, white, professional class. There was this, you know, Pennsylvania Dutch twinge. And I'll be honest with you, it was nothing that I identified with. I just thought, okay, this is weird. I had this image of like, maybe my ancestors were Amish, you know, old order Amish, but I didn't really weren't that. And, you know, my parents would say, oh, well, they're fancy Dutch. It didn't mean anything to me. So I actually, to be honest, there was this connection that was always there. On the other hand, it wasn't something that I really, I guess, felt kind of connected with until I moved here, and I was already 37 years old. And I moved here because actually I moved to Wilmersdorf. I wanted to live in a small town. I'd lived on a little island as a anthropologist. And I said, well, I wonder if little communities in Pennsylvania, you know, I'd driven through these communities, always wondered what they were about. You know, what is, you know, Fleetwood, why is it there? Why are these all these little towns? Coming from the suburbs of Philadelphia, you know, you thought you were going out to hillbilly country or something. And so I lived on this little island of about 250 people. I said, I wonder if small towns are like little islands. And Wilmersdorf was the only thing that stuck in my mind. So actually, I moved to a town called Hoest, which I don't know if you know, it's a suburb of Wilmersdorf. And that's how I started. And I saw an advertisement of all places, the Reading Eagle, for an anthropologist to teach at Kutztown. And that's where I started.
you segued perfectly, but I want to go back a little bit. So, you know, you grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia, and then you decided to go on to college and you studied anthropology.
Right.
Now, for people that don't know, I mean, I'm not saying that my audience is stupid, but let's give the quick five second or the elevator pitch. What is anthropology, and what does an anthropologist do?
Well, when I it's changed now, but remember I started college in 1968. Anthropologists study other cultures around the world, and what we think is the best way to learn about another group of people is to go live with them. So, as I said, for about 2.5 years, I lived on this little island out in the Pacific with a group of Polynesians.
Well,
And
can I ask you a question about that?
yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, it came about first. I was interested in archaeology. I was interested in like Bronze Age archaeology, Greek archaeology, if you know anything about that. And I took a course in anthropology in college. I think I was a sophomore. And I said, you know what? I don't have to dig up old people. You know what I can find is about other people who were, living in less complex societies. And this is what anthropologists study. So that's how I became interested. My professor had done field research in New Guinea out in the Pacific. And so when I went to graduate school, that's the area of the world I was interested in. And it just turned out I was very lucky. My dissertation advisor had been to the Solomon Islands, knew a lot about that area. And he said, oh, there's this little island. It's called Sikaiana. People may know the Solomon Islands from the Battle of Guadalcanal in World War II. And then Sikaiana was actually, there's something called it was a naval battle between aircraft carriers. The Battle of Eastern Solomons was actually right on top of Sikaiana. And they had pretty vivid memories of it when I got there in 1980, and they still remember
So,
a lot.
never having experienced something like that, I just have always thought about this. I knew this experience that you had, but I never got a chance to talk to you. So there you are, this white college kid from Philadelphia,
Yeah.
dropped onto this Polynesian island in the middle of the Pacific. And how do you even go about like, okay, you're there to study these people and learn about their culture, but how do you do that as an outsider, like so di coming from such a different background and being dropped into this very isolated place? How do you
Yeah.
even start that? How does that work?
Yeah, I look back, I can't believe I did it. That's a lot of other people who think that as well. But that's what anthropologists do. We plunk ourselves down, and all the other people I knew who were graduate students were planning to do that in different parts of the world. A lot of our professors had done that. Actually, see, kind of people were really not, you get different experiences around the world. Some people can be pretty nasty, but the see kind of people were really nice. They had very good experiences with Americans during World War II. They liked the Americans. And to be honest, it was kind of like being a celebrity, like a rock star or something. Everybody wanted to talk to me. Everybody, what's America like? And they made sure I survived. Part of it was, just what anthropologists do. Part of it was I was very lucky to live with a group of people that were going to help me learn their culture. Now, one thing that you might find interesting, they find their culture, and when I was there in the 1980s, they felt it was changing rapidly. They felt they might be losing their language, and they were interested in somebody recording their traditional culture. And they have lost their language. I'm told that they don't speak it anymore. And there's some parallels with Pennsylvania Germans. The loss of the language, the change from a more traditional culture to a more modern one. Events that celebrate the past. When I was there, see kind of people were doing that. They would have special ceremonies that celebrated their heritage, and we have the Kutztown Folk Festival. So, as it turned out, there were, some parallels between the lives of those two people.
How long did it take for you to be there until you felt accepted or that you were like fitting in?
I would say, it's off and on. You have some days, what am I doing here? Everybody hates me, as you go along. But, they were always, there were some bumps, but they were pretty nice. Once I started speaking the language, and that would have been about 9 months, a year. Now, I wasn't, I got better and better as I went along, but they were really impressed. They thought there was something wrong with their language because none of the white people they knew had ever learned it. And the fact that I was learning it pretty well, that really impressed them. And that really became a kind of, I don't know, a bond, I guess, and still is in lots of respects. So that happened. They had more experience with white people, Europeans, than I had experience with Polynesians. So they knew more about me than I knew about them, at least in the beginning. But they were good.
What's one thing from your time on that island that still in your mind was like one of the most shocking things that you saw in this culture that was so different from yours?
Well, the thing I always tell students in my introductory classes is they have a system of fosterage. And when a woman's pregnant, different people come up to her and say, I want to take your child. And they will. And almost every child has been moved from, one family to another family, oftentimes through several families. I remember once interviewing a person. I said, well, who were your foster parents? And he said, well, I didn't have any. And somebody who was listening to the interview said, well, he wasn't loved. They see this as a sign of love. And when I talked to a woman, I remember saying, well, look, what is all this stuff about fosterage? At that point, I could speak the language. And she said, you white people, actually, that term white means something different to them than it does to us. But anyway, they'll put Chinese in with white people and, all sorts of things. Anyway, she said, I said, no, we don't do it. And she said, Koto tama ma he aloha i te aloha. She used this word aloha, which is a very powerful word in Polynesian languages for love, compassion. She said, you white people don't know anything about love. From her perspective, moving the children around was love. Now, from our perspective, it's lack of love. But they're a society where, they really care about other people. They see, it takes a village. I don't know if Hillary Clinton really lived in a village, but it does in these societies take a village. And so actually, the moving the children around is a show of love. So that's, one of the big things I think I took away from that society. And one of the ways, when I'm telling students about how other people can be different and what seems weird or wrong, once you understand it from the inside, can actually make sense. That's probably the most, I don't know, the biggest example that I often talk about. So.
So let's fast forward. You did all that research, and then you got into academia, and you found your way to Wilmersdorf, as you mentioned, and then
Wilmersdorf,
eventually to
yeah.
a
Went to
teaching
Reading
position.
Eagle. I can't believe, all these anthropology journals, no jobs, no jobs. A Reading Eagle, anthropologist.
There you go. And you find yourself at Kutztown University, and you are currently the Freiberger Professor of Pennsylvania German Studies at Kutztown, and also in the anthropology department. So I have some questions from your perspective about some of this. We've already touched a little bit about Pennsylvania Dutch things and Pennsylvania German things. And you know the work that I do, and the audience does too. But I've had a couple interactions recently that have had me start to think about things maybe from a different perspective, and or at least think about them from a different perspective. And I wanted to run some of these ideas by you, since given your background and you're a professional anthropologist, there was recently a heated conversation on Facebook. I was not involved, but I was watching this conversation unfold, and it was on one of these Pennsylvania Dutch group sites where people that are Pennsylvania Dutch were talking about all different things, whether it was food or memories from their grandparents, et cetera. But a pretty heated conversation got started, and it continued, and a lot of different voices started jumping in. And essentially, they were arguing over what does it mean to be Pennsylvania Dutch. Some people were making this argument that, well, if you're not, if your ancestors weren't Pennsylvania Dutch, then you're not Pennsylvania Dutch. And then there were people that were saying, well, if you practice the old type of traditions, and if you're a Protestant Christian, then you can be Pennsylvania Dutch. And then there were all these people that were, or other people that were completely saying the exact opposite. Well, that's not necessarily the case, because just because I'm not a Christian or a Protestant, that shouldn't disqualify me for being Pennsylvania Dutch. So thinking of it from the anthropologist's perspective, let me ask you a couple questions about this conversation that I was really thinking about.
Yeah, I want to talk about that conversation. Yeah.
What makes someone or some group Pennsylvania Dutch? We'll stick with that topic and that culture, because it's the one that we know so well. So what, in your mind as an anthropologist, how do you answer that question? What makes someone or some group of people X? In this case, we're going to say Pennsylvania Dutch.
All right, now I'm going to have to give you a pointy-headed academic answer to
That's
that.
fine.
Everybody's right. For some people, and generally as anthropologists, we like to follow what people think. Some people will just be a matter of ancestry. For some people, it's going to be speaking the language. For others, it's going to be self-identity. One of the things in contemporary American society, I don't want to offend your audiences, but we're very labile in terms of how people define their identity. We have white people claiming to be black. We have senators claiming to be Native American. We have, biological males who are claiming to be females. And so I remember being at a conference actually at the center at Elizabethtown College, and somebody asked me that question. I said, well, you know, if you call yourself Pennsylvania Dutch, I guess you're Pennsylvania Dutch. Now, that's the most, you know, kind of flexible answer. But, and I know some people are going to be offended by that. But I think there are all sorts of different definitions of, you know, identity today across the board in all sorts of different ways. And I think, you know, we have to be open to the fact that different people are going to have different notions about what it means to be Pennsylvania Dutch. I'm glad you asked that question because I want you involved in this. We're thinking, Patrick and myself, Patrick Dunmoyer, who your audience should know, he's just this fantastic director at the Heritage Center. He really has made that a real center for Pennsylvania German studies here at Kutztown. I wouldn't be a Freiburger professor if it wasn't for him really getting that center going. Anyway, we're talking, thinking about having a conference about the future of Pennsylvania Germans and the future of Pennsylvania German studies. And we want to have some leading scholars. We've talked to Josh Brown, I'm sure you know him, and Steve Nolt, and Mark Loudon, and Simon Bronner, and some others. And we'd like to have a conference, but we'd also like to have, people like you who are involved. I don't know if you know Richard Miller down here, who's done a lot of things, but people who are active amongst Pennsylvania Germans don't necessarily have that food after their name, but are very, you know, active in what the culture is and what the culture is becoming. And see if we, I don't know, you know, what will we define as the future of Pennsylvania Germans and what will we define as the future of Pennsylvania German studies? And I'd just like to have a, you know, a real talk about what that means. And maybe, you know, they talk about people who study American ethnicity talk about the fact, well, at least the European groups have all lost their, they've all assimilated. So the Irish, the Italians, you know, the Greeks, they're all assimilated into a general American culture. The studies of German Americans, they assimilated. One of the interesting things is it's pretty clear the German Americans assimilated faster than the Pennsylvania Germans. Usually the German Americans followed a pattern of, you know, one or two generations and assimilated. Pennsylvania Germans lasted what, 9, 10 generations. Since World War II, you know, the argument is, yeah, well, maybe they're following this pattern where they just see themselves as somehow white, Northern European, something like that. So we'll have to, you know, see what how we fit into that thing. The argument is for ethnic groups, many of these ethnic groups, ethnicity has now become something celebratory, somehow symbolic and temporary, like you're Irish on St. Patrick's Day or you're Italian on Columbus Day. You have a few symbolic things. You're Pennsylvania German at the folk festival. I'm not sure that's really the whole story here, but that's, you know, one of the things we want to look at. What does it mean to be Pennsylvania German? And again, that question, who is? We're going to get a lot of different answers, but I think the answer is there may be a lot of different answers. One thing that I think is pretty clear is since World War II, there have been some pretty dramatic changes in terms of language loss, in terms of assimilation, in terms of you know, what's happening. Before World War II, there was a remarkable stability, you know, preservation of a language and, you know, a distinctive culture. So, you know, one thing you might want to look at is what's happened over the last, you know, 50, 70 years.
I guess that's a great follow-up because the question I have next is, and again, going back to this conversation that was happening on Facebook, is a culture only defined by its past?
That's exactly, you know, it's Pennsylvania German studies in the future just going to be about the past? Or are we just going to be talking about, you know, things people were doing 50 or 100 years ago? You know, somebody will find a new manuscript that Henry Harbaugh wrote, and that's, you know, going to give us some insight into, you know, something in the 19th century. I'm kind of hoping, you see, I think people like you are creating a kind of future. And you're ironically, you're using the internet, you're using, you know, this high technology, digitalization for a way to create a new way to be Pennsylvania German. Now,
Yeah, it's great. You just said that because it was another question I had was, and I guess you just answered it, but I'm going to ask it again anyway. How does a culture evolve? Is it organic? Is it that the group of people that are in this culture, they decide this is the direction we're going to go? Or is it, I'm sure it's much deeper than that, but in your mind as an anthropologist, how does a culture evolve?
well, I guess yeah, that's a good question. That's you know, five doctoral dissertations. Usually for an anthropologist, we look at context, and a lot of it has, you know, historically been the environment. What is the environment like? And then what is the technology people develop to live in that environment? And we see as environments change slightly, pretty stable around the world until recently, at least, people develop technology, which then, changed in a sense who they were. And we think to some extent, the ideology of religion, that's all connected with technology. They reinforce, we have this idea of functionalism, different aspects of a culture seem to reinforce one another. I would say the major changes that you see globally over the last 50 or 100 years have been globalization, that there are these really powerful economic and cultural forces, part of them outgrowth of colonialism, part of them migration of Europeans to different parts of the world. And then part of it is the kind of super complex economic systems, capitalism, industrialization, the technology. Lord knows what, I don't know what's going to happen with AI and the internet and all the different things. One thing, see kind of people, they don't use their language much, but those, a lot of them migrate to a town, they're on Facebook. They're friends of mine on Facebook. I can follow what's going on. And I couldn't imagine that, when I was there 40 years ago. But there are these global processes that really seem to be affecting everybody. At the same time, you see some kind of backlash, people wanting to kind of reassert some kind of indigenous or special identity to kind of, I think, give them some anchoring in a rapidly changing culture, which we'll look at.
I think that was one of the cruxes of that argument that was on Facebook, is because there were a lot of people that kept coming back to, well, how things were in the past is what defines us. And then there were people that were saying, but that's, okay, I get that, but that's shutting, many generations out of the conversation that didn't live in the past that are living now. And I guess another kind of question I was thinking about that I wrote down was, what happens when, if we're looking at a culture, and we'll say the Pennsylvania Dutch or whoever, what happens when the present is so different from the past?
Let me just back up to one thing. One of my things is the Pennsylvania Germans were not the same. Their pasts were changing. And so if you start in 1730, somebody who was born then, by 1800, by the end of their life, they're living in a different culture, really a different society. And then somebody born in 1800, take them to 1870. They've gone through the Civil War. They've got the early parts of mechanization. Pennsylvania Germans are starting to write in a language that was never written. And then you go another 70 years. What does that take us to 1940? Again, you're getting somebody who's different. And so, it's not as if, Pennsylvania Germans were the same people from, 1700 to 1950. They were constantly changing. And then the question is, well, the changes that we've seen over the last 75 years seem especially dramatic and especially assimilating. And maybe that's a change that changes everything. If we're no longer talking about change of a people who are changing in terms of their identity, but that's just, it's just leveled everything. That's one possibility. But one thing about change is, if you don't change, you end. So Latin's a dead language, except it's alive. It's Spanish. It's, I tell people it's Italian. It's all these other languages, and that's because it changed. And so, as you look at things, there's always this constant change. And people look back in the past and say, well, this isn't, the past, but the past itself was so different. So I don't
Yeah,
know
and I think also
if I'm.
too many people have an image of what the past was, and the reality is most likely quite different from what they imagine it to have been.
Yeah, no, I think that's true too. I think, the past was a lot rougher than people like to remember.
Another question I have for you as an anthropologist, I have a lot of friends in Europe and I travel to Germany quite a bit. And when you talk to Germans about cultural identity and things like that, I mean, most Germans for the most part, they're like, yeah, okay, I'm a German. Or, some will say, well, I'm a European. There are certain regions of Germany, actually, the region where most of the Pennsylvania Dutch come from, the Pals, they're pretty proud to be Palatinate or Pfälzisch. But why do you think it is so important, or what it seems important to me, to a lot of Americans, to be able to say their cultural identity? I'm Italian American, or I'm Greek American, or I'm Pennsylvania Dutch. Why do you think it is that unique to America, do you think? And if so, or if not, why or why not?
That's a very good question, and I'm not sure I have an answer to that. Part of it is that There are these processes where people don't want to be Italian American. They want to be American. They don't want to speak. You know, that's how Italian got lost. That's probably how Pennsylvania Dutch got lost, you know, in the mid-century. There were a lot of people saying, oh, you know, that accent, you know, that's something that's not good. And they want to be part of a national movement. At the same time, there's this sense, you know, I want to be special. I want to be different. And that difference comes from ethnicities. And, you know, the United States, the conservatives have a point here about what are the identity wars or something, that everything has to be, you know, seen in terms of a particular identity. And this, you know, speaks to Native Americans that, and, you know, outsiders are now, I think, appreciating non-Native Americans, appreciating Native American identity more than they did before. So we have these two forces going on. And on the one hand, people want to seem to have a unique special identity. On the other hand, there's all these pressures to assimilate into a larger one. But you know what? I want to turn the question around because you're really the expert. I don't know why you're asking me all these questions. What do you think is means to be Pennsylvania Dutch or Pennsylvania German?
Well, I agree with you. I mean, the answer is it could be anything. You know, it could be the person that is a descendant, you know, whose families have been here for 9 generations or 10 generations. But to me, any, you know, I talk to a lot of people that have, you know, Rich Riley, who you probably know from. Here's a prime example. Here's this guy that has no Pennsylvania Dutch blood, no ethnic ties to the culture community. He moves into southeastern Pennsylvania. He's fascinated by this culture, and he decides to learn the language. And here's a guy that's writing and speaking in Pennsylvania Dutch better than a lot of people that claim to be Pennsylvania Dutch, say, I'm a proud Pennsylvania Dutchman. And to me, I would throw that guy a Pennsylvania Dutch jacket or a badge or whatever you want to say and say, you are Pennsylvania Dutch. And I know that would anger some people, but that's kind of the opinion I'm at. If anyone that, you know, anybody can be any of these things. If you're celebrating our culture, if you're celebrating our traditions, if you're learning our language, if you're learning about us and taking an interest in it, to me, that's a tip of the hat to you. And, you know, of course, there is going to be the people that can truly, I guess, you know, you could truly claim, well, I am definitely Pennsylvania Dutch. My eighth great grandfather was one of the founding farmers in the Ole Valley and all these, and I can say I can make those claims, but you know, there's times where I don't feel any more Pennsylvania Dutch than Rich Riley, a guy that just learned the language and doesn't have that rich history and cultural ties. You know, there were very few kids in the 1980s that were growing up in the background in the community that I grew up in, where we were still continuing a lot of these older traditions, where I had all four grandparents that spoke the language around me as a kid, I never heard my grandparents ever say that they were ashamed of their accent or they were ashamed to be Pennsylvania Dutch. And this was the World War II generation. And my grandmother, her brother was killed in Europe during the war. You know, he was drafted by the army and sent over and was killed by Germans in France. And yet my grandmother never disowned that part of who she was. So just growing up, it was never a question of, it was just always there. And that's who I am. You know what I mean? For me. But, you know, I agree with your answer. To me, it's anybody. And the beautiful thing I think is that we had that post-World War II, like my parents' generation, that did start to really shy away from it, stop learning the language, or like my grandparents didn't necessarily actively pass the language on to their kids, and that whole World War II generation and the Depression generation. But the work that I do, and you see this as well with the work that you do, I really think that right now, our culture is going through a renaissance of some kind, particularly with the work that's being done by different people on the internet. People have a better access now to learn the language than ever before. We look at what the Berks History Center is doing with Zoom classes, and Lehigh Carbon Community College is doing that. And there's other places too. And they're throwing this out there and people can't get enough of it. And, you know, we're selling clothing with Pennsylvania Dutch motifs and language on it, and people are buying it and they're wearing it and they're talking about it. You know, nobody did that 20, 30 years ago. So, and why is that happening? I don't know. Maybe some of it is that people, you know, what we talked about earlier, but this idea of like, they're identifying with this, they're proud of it. And they want to tell people about it, not in a pushy in your face kind of way, but, and that's kind of the message I preach in my videos and things, is there's nothing wrong with showing off your cultural identity. you know, we have a story to be proud of. And I think it's important for us to tell our story, not evangelize or anything, but to at least tell our story. And I would welcome any culture, any subculture group in the United States to do the same thing. I agree with you. I think the Native Americans have started to really embrace the ability to tell their stories now too. And, you know, we're hearing way more about those cultures than we did 20, 30 years ago. So yeah, I don't know. I kind of digressed there a little bit, but that's kind of when I look at the people that I interact with and the work that I do, those are the kinds of, and a lot of it too, is I get a lot of people that'll say like, I know I'm Pennsylvania Dutch because mom or dad said I was, or my grandparents were, but I don't know what that means. Help me understand what that means. Oh, okay. Well, let's talk about our history, or let's talk about our language, or let's talk about the culture. And if those, to me, it's a victory if those people decide, you know what, I'm going to pick up one of these old traditions that my family did, and I'm going to start practicing it, or I'm going to start making a certain Pennsylvania Dutch food item that maybe my family hasn't made for a generation. I'm going to bring this back. And then they're going to hopefully pass that on to their kids. And yeah, I mean, when I was a kid in the 1980s and we would go grocery shopping in Hamburg with my grandparents, it was common for my grandfather to stop on the sidewalk and have a full conversation in Pennsylvania Dutch with one of his old buddies, or, you know, and hear the language. I'm never expecting that will ever come back, because that, I'm a realist. But if somebody learns a word or two or three, then in my mind, the language lives on. You know, that person might never be able to hold a conversation or give a speech or whatever, but if they can say "kunst du mich gefangen," or if they could pledge the flag in Pennsylvania Dutch, or they learn the word "grundsau" or whatever, in my mind, that language lives on for another however many years. So that's kind of where I'm at in all of this.
You know, Mark Loudon, I don't know if you've heard him talk about post-vernacular. You should interview him. He's talked about the fact that, I guess, Yiddish, you can split between the Hasidics, who keep the line, in fact, have kind of reinvented the language, and then most Jewish people whose grandparents spoke Yiddish, but they know, like, you know, 40 words. And he calls this post-vernacular, and he says that's what's happening with Pennsylvania Dutch, that you have that group, the old order groups, who preserve the language. And then a lot of the rest of us who, you know, have, say, we'll come here once and, you know, I'm feeling threatsy and, you know, we'll have pork and sauerkraut on New Year's. And, you know, I think, you know, one thing you can look at as well, is this just superficial or is this somehow deep meaning? I think it, you know, it can be taken both ways, but I think there probably is more meaning to the people who participate in it. One thing, just using you as an example, I think you're a great example. There's the internet, which, you know, this is something new technology, and you're really active in that. One thing you do that I really admire, this Ask a Dutchman thing. You really pull out what I see as a traditional way of Pennsylvania German humor, of being funny, of being kind of self-deprecating, but also ironic in that self-deprecation. You're actually brilliant at it. And to me, that actually is, it's, you know, there are broader humor traditions, and it's actually, you know, there's Mark Twain and, you know, Will Rogers. There is, you know, like a big strain in it. But the Pennsylvania Germans, I think, picked up on it more than any other ethnic group. And you're really brilliant at that. And that, to me, you know, continue that. That's actually, to me, a hardcore tradition that is important. And I think something that does, you know, really tie down to the, you know, to the roots of Pennsylvania Germans. So
no one has ever really, I appreciate those comments very, very much, Bill. It means a lot coming from you, but I've never talked about that to really anybody. You know, the stuff that Chris and I do in these, you know, we always say we're going to talk dumb for 5 minutes, and that's what the Pennsylvania Dutch would always say. But I grew up listening to, my grandparents often had, you know, Professor Schnitzel records on, or Dopey Duncan, these giants of Pennsylvania Dutch humor. And the joy I used to see that it brought my grandparents and their friends was contagious to me. And I didn't actively say to myself, I want to do this one day. I never, ever thought that. If you would ask 18-year-old Doug if he'd be doing the stuff that he's doing today, he would have just laughed at you. No way. So somehow that got like ingrained in me somehow internally. And when we first started doing that series, nothing was planned, nothing was scripted out, and it just naturally happened. And every video we've done over like, I don't know, 160 episodes of that. And none of it's ever been scripted. I don't know if that's just, maybe that sense of humor is in us as a culture. And I just can, I don't know, maybe I can just tap into it a little bit easier than maybe some people. I don't know. But there's something about that style of humor and storytelling that I find powerful. I don't set out to do it in a powerful way, but it connects with a lot of people. I don't know how else to say it. The Germans say when something is done with a lot of emotion and it comes from deep within, they say it has heart blood in it. That's literally what they say, Herzenblut. And I think sometimes that when we're doing stuff in Pennsylvania Dutch, when Chris and I are performing, like we're going to be at a Groundhog Lodge event tomorrow and when or on Saturday, when we're performing, between both him and I is that there's that heart blood in it. I don't know what the best word in English would be for it, but it's coming from somewhere deep within.
Yeah.
Whether that's in my DNA or, you know, just natural, I don't know. But I really appreciate you saying those things.
Yeah,
that was
yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's not just dumb stuff. I mean, the irony, you have some things where, you know, you get some real insights into what's going on in the world by playing the role of the, you know, it's not really the dumb Dutchman, but it may, you know, but it's, you know, it's a real strain in American humor where, you know, Mark Twain would play this and Will Rogers and Clarence Ron was the minister. People would act like they're, you know, kind of common, ordinary folk and then show some real insight into what's going on through humor. So,
well, I want to ask you one last question in this part of the interview, and that is, since you've been studying this culture for so many years, what is something that that you have learned from this culture? Not necessarily a fact or, you know, but what is studying the Pennsylvania Dutch taught you?
Well, I think that's, you know, the things we were talking about. One is that they changed over time, that they were doing different things in different times. One of the things that I find, you know, growing up in Philadelphia, I had no interest, no appreciation. Somebody once said to me, well, I was at the University of Pennsylvania when Don Yoder was there. I said, you know, I didn't care. I wanted to study Polynesia. But as I got into it, you know, I started actually really admiring the way in which they preserved culture, but also recreated it creatively in all sorts of different ways. And so, you know, the literature that they developed, that was not something they brought over from Germany, but Harbaugh and Thomas Harder, you know, the things that were sometimes nostalgic, but sometimes also humorous. The kind of humor you're talking about, you know, Boonestiel to me is, you know, this guy who says, well, I'm just an ordinary drunk and then has these insights into what's going on. And to me, that was a real creative thing that they made. And then the Groundhog Lodges, that was something else. That's not German, you know, that's something that's American, but Pennsylvania Dutch American. And then again, the humor that they used there, the way they created things. And then the folk festivals, you know, mid-century. They seem to, they're creative people and the way in which they look at their culture, they creatively reconstruct new ways to express their culture. And that's kind of what you're doing on the internet. And that's something I really came to appreciate and admire about them. And so, you know, that was one of the big takeaways that of that. The other thing I found is they were always, well, till recently maybe, but always Pennsylvania Dutch and American, that somehow they figured out a way to be both really ethnic and also really American. And as I said, part of it is incorporating American oral traditions, humor traditions, literary traditions into their daily lives, but also somehow incorporating broader American values at the same time that they preserve their own sense of being somehow different. That was pretty impressive to me as well.
That's great. Well, we're going to get out of the heavy conversation stuff. We end every episode with 10 quick questions that I ask all my guests that have nothing to do with anything we talked about, but just to get to know Bill Donner a little bit better.
Okay.
So here we go. Question number one, what is your morning drink of choice?
Coffee, decaf coffee. When decaf. I was younger, it would be real coffee, but now, you know, I'm getting old. The real coffee will keep me awake. So decaf coffee, that's what I drink.
So I have a quick follow-up question. When you were in Polynesia, what was their morning drink of choice? What in that culture?
Well, now, actually, you could get instant coffee. You could go to town. There was a boat once a month. It took 36 hours to get there. But
oh my God.
I would take lots of cans of instant coffee And I had a little Bunsen burner that I light up and heat it up. And I had, well, run out because sometimes the boat didn't come, but as often as I could, I would have coffee. They'd drink tea.
They drink tea. Okay.
They was a British colony. They were into tea.
Okay. Question number two. Who is a go-to musical artist or group for you?
It's going to take too long to explain this, but I have a special story about Bonnie Raitt.
Okay. Look,
When I
Bonnie
was
Raitt's great.
in college, I was doing an ethnographic research project, and I decided to do the blues. And I wanted to, was it Lightning Hopkins or some famous blues guy that was always coming out to the main point out in Lancaster Avenue, actually, in Bryn Mawr. And he was always too drunk. And then Bonnie Raitt, before she was famous, talked to me. I interviewed Bonnie Raitt. And I'll be honest with you, I hope I don't offend anybody there. I said, a white woman doing the blues, I want a black guy. All right. So she was really nice to me. And I was kind of okay. And the person from Warner Brothers came and she had cut her first record. And she kind of blew off the person from Warner Brothers to talk to me. She was so nice, but she wasn't famous yet. And I have, if I can just follow up on that, I was talking to students this past year and I said to them, okay, whenever you have an informant, treat them like they're a rock star. And I told them my Bonnie Raitt story. You're talking to somebody, just they could be important, you don't know, just pretend they're going to be important. And they never heard of Bonnie Raitt. And this was, I was just so embarrassed, they were like rolling their eyes, looking at me. That was the week she got the Grammy for Best Artist. I came back to that class next week. I said, okay, your professor's an idiot. Well, what about Bonnie Raitt?
That's good.
Where's my Bonnie Raitt story?
That's a good one. That's
That's
good.
my favorite story.
All right. Question number three. What movie can you watch over and over again and it never gets old?
Oh, gee. One I like it, I'm embarrassed to admit it, Goodfellas.
No, that's a great
I
film. There's nothing to be
like.
embarrassed about.
That's one that I'll
That's
watch.
a good film. That's a good film.
I got my girlfriend to watch Midnight Cowboy again. She didn't like it,
Oh.
but I liked it.
Yeah. You do this a lot for your career, but I'll ask this question. What is the last thing that you read?
Oh, yeah, I think you got me. What is the last book that I read? I don't read that much anymore. I read like articles. I'll tell you what I read, which was pretty cool. Patrick Dunmoyer just wrote a article that he hasn't published yet, but that's actually the very I read it this morning. He had a pretty cool article about these. I'm not sure they do it in Germany, but they're these kind of house sayings. When somebody finishes a house, there's a kind of saying that they have about to keep it blessed or something. And then it also has a ribald content to it, and it's kind of like the New Year's wish. That's
Oh, okay.
a good article. So that's actually I read that this morning. So that's not a book, but an
Oh,
article.
that's fine. That's fine. All right. Question number five. What's your favorite pizza topping?
My favorite pizza
Pete.
topping.
Yeah.
Everything, I guess.
Yeah,
I
that's
don't know
okay.
why you have everything on it.
All right. Question number six. Laying on the beach or going for a hike?
Oh, it really depends. I think mostly going for a hike.
Okay.
I like the beach, but not laying on it so much.
Yeah. Number seven, you have invited me over for dinner. What are you making?
I can tell you don't want what I make, but my girlfriend will make you stuffed salmon, and it's really good. So,
I like salmon,
and
so
I don't know if I
that's
can
no
add for
issue.
Costco, that's they have really good stuffed salmon, so
There we go.
that's probably what you get.
You've done a lot of traveling in your life, but number eight, what is a dream vacation destination for you?
I gotta be honest, I don't really like vacations because I like to go someplace and stay there for years. So
Okay, so what is what?
I'm not really into that.
But
I
where's a
prefer.
place? Where's a place in the world you'd really like to see?
Well, I had a conference out in Hawaii last year, and that was nice. Sorry, I think one of my nieces is getting married up in where is it, Fairbanks, Alaska. I'd like to go there.
Yeah.
Weird places.
No, that's okay. Number nine. What is something you're afraid of?
I don't know, growing old.
Okay.
I think, yeah, I think
That's a good one. No, that's good. All right. And the last question, what job other than one that you've had would you love to have?
Oh, boy. Let me think. Okay, I'm going to tell you something that's really weird, and I'm embarrassed to tell you this, but I was a Vietnam War protester, and I have two sons in the military now, and one of them's in special forces, and I guess this is an old male thing, you know, I think, you know, that kind of thing would be actually kind of cool, and I know I'm not supposed to say that, probably everybody, you know, half the liberals on listening to this are going to hate me, but you asked me, and so
no, that's it's that's it doesn't something. Matter doesn't matter doesn't matter what the listeners
the,
are thinking.
Both of them, actually, the kind of skills they have, I think, are really really cool. And so you know, I hated the military and during the Vietnam War, and now I'm like, you know, they're really teaching them good skills, they're challenged in lots of important kinds of ways, and I think the other one's in cyber stuff, and I think they're doing cool stuff. So
That's a great answer. That's a great answer. Well, Bill, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. The time goes so fast whenever we have these conversations. It's like I look up and I'm like, holy crap, we got to get going. But I appreciate everything that you do. I mean, you were saying about the stuff you appreciate of me, but I have to say this too. Having worked with you on various things over the last couple of years, I just want to thank you for all the work that you're doing, the work that I know you will continue to do with, you know, being at the university and the Folk Festival and the other research that you've done. You've added to our Pennsylvania Dutch story in a great way and in ways that we can't put a price on. So I just want to thank you for that work that you've done.
Oh, sure. Well, I think my main job is to appreciate people like you. And we're going to have a conference. We're going to get together at a conference about the future.
I can't wait. That sounds beyond great. So I will, as soon as I get the invitation, I will accept.
Okay, great. Great.
All right. Thanks, Bill. Well, we'll see each other soon. I'm sure it's somewhere down the road. But until then, take care, my friend.
Folk Festival, at least, if not before.
Absolutely, if not before.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
Thanks a lot. This was fun.
Thank you for listening to Doug's Front Porch, a conversational podcast with your host, Doug Maidenford. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Your ratings and reviews will help others find the show. You can follow along on Facebook, X, and Instagram. Just look for Doug's Front Porch. If you would like to financially support our endeavors, there's a Buy Me a Coffee link in the show notes. I thank you in advance for any contributions. Please feel free to tell all your friends about the show, and I'll see you all next time on My Front Porch.